started. Is that your move? Maybe. Maybe that'll continue to work today. All right, we are in Daniel chapter 8, into this apocalyptic part of the book of Daniel. We won't retread all the ground we talked about last time about these visions and how to interpret them, except to just kind of get our minds back in the idea that there are just loads and loads of images being used in these visions, and you can't focus on every single detail and try to make it mean something, because that will get you into a spot where you say crazy things about what it means. And so if you're looking at the big picture of the vision, the big picture of the image, and what you're getting from that big picture. In these, you just about always have some help, because another key part of these apocalyptic visions is somewhere along the line you've got this spiritual being, and Daniel typically it's an angel specifically that helps interpret the vision and tells you what part of it means, and we'll run into that here again as we have this vision here in Daniel 8 of the ram and the goat, and then there is a little horn that will grow up out of a broken horn on the goat, and those are kind of the three key figures, I guess, in Daniel chapter 8. Before we get into this, let me just mention one thing as we are moving forward in our classes. Adam finished 2 Corinthians this past Wednesday, and I had batted around the idea of just taking Daniel and doing both classes with Daniel to expedite its completion, especially since, like I said, I taught it last semester at college, and I really try not to double up on that sort of thing, in part because it feels lazy to me, and also because I don't want students that are in both places to have to listen to the same thing twice. And so I thought about doing that to speed it up, but then I also realized that we've got a group of younger students in the Sunday morning class here that aren't in the Wednesday night class, and I don't want to take away half of the rest of the book from them. And so what we're going to do is Tom's going to start teaching on Wednesday night. He's going to teach the book of Matthew, which we went back and checked records. We have not done Matthew here in 10 years. So it's been a little while, so we'll go back and we'll be doing that on Wednesday night and continue Daniel until we wrap it up, and then kind of move forward from whatever else we're going to do there. Well, this is presuming, of course, Tom is better. He's not feeling well today. I don't know. I don't think we know exactly what's going on. Joy said that he was concerned that it's his gallbladder. So if it's something related to that and then it gets especially bad, he may or may not be here on Wednesday. So we'll figure that all out as we go. Let's begin, though, with prayer. Our Father, as we continue to consider this book that speaks of your sovereignty, we are getting comforted that however things may seem to us now, that you are in control of this world. What happens here, that kingdoms rise and fall at your word, and that however things may seem at the present for your people, your kingdom will be victorious. And so we ask that you would help us to be encouraged further as we study, that our faith and commitment to you will grow, that as we face the battles of this life, we will stand on your side, knowing that in our faith we will have the victory that overcomes this world. We ask that you be with Tom and help him feel better, help him to recover, and be back with us soon. Be with us now as we study your word, that we will grow in it. Alright, so first thing I want to do is we get into Daniel chapter 8. I could just put that off the top of the screen, but I'm not going to mess with that. Is give just a little bit of historical background, because it's important to know something about the history of Persia and Greece as you get into this chapter. It makes it make a whole lot more sense than if you don't know anything about that. So very quickly, in like a 5-minute version of Persian and Greek history, I'll show you how thorough this is going to be, right? Really brief overview of the some of the high parts. So the Persian Empire was really a two-part empire at the outset. We've talked about this. It was the kingdom of the Medes, the kingdom of the Persians, were joined together under Cyrus, whose mother was a Mede and his father was a Persian, so that kind of worked out nicely. In the first year of Belshazzar, as we talked about last time in Daniel 7:1, Cyrus conquered, Cyrus the Persian is how he reigned. He conquered the Median Empire and joined them together as a single nation. Initially, the Medians were the stronger of the two powers, but by the time Cyrus came along, the Persians became the stronger part of the two, and ultimately so much stronger that typically today, historians just talk about the Persian Empire. I mean, unless they're really focusing on those kinds of details, it's just the Persian Empire. That's how much stronger the Persian part got by the end of it. The Persian Empire was situated at the far east of civilization, I use that term loosely, of course, but think of the Fertile Crescent, the biblical world, the Mediterranean, and over toward the Tigris and Euphrates and all of that. Persia is about as far east in that part of the world as you can go. And so as they made military campaigns to expand their empire, they didn't typically go east. They went west and south and north back toward, again, civilization, use that term loosely. For the most part, their campaigns were very successful, especially under Cyrus, less so as time went on. That's kind of the thing about a lot of these major world empires, the ancient world. You would have a brilliant strategic leader that would, you know, make their rise meteoric to a point of prominence, a great power. They would take over the world, and that power, it would be kind of residual for a little while, but after that person died, it began to taper off. So after Nebuchadnezzar died, the Babylonians began to fall off. After Cyrus died, Persians, a little bit more slowly, but they began to taper off. Of course, after Alexander, complete nightmare there as far as how that all works out, because there was no successor to Alexander, but we'll come to that in just a moment. And so Cyrus' son Cambyses, then King Darius after him, and Xerxes and Artaxerxes. So there were a few. They didn't drop off quite as quickly as the Babylonians, but they were never after Cyrus what they were during the time of Cyrus. But they kept trying to expand into Egypt and Greece. And in particular, their campaigns against the Greeks faltered under Xerxes, and the one thing it very much succeeded in doing was making the Greeks very, very angry at the Persians. They just hated the Persians more than just about anything. And so when Alexander came to power and the Greeks came to power, the Persians were very high on their list of people to take down. For one reason, because they're the world power, and to be the world power, you've got to beat the world power. But also because they really, really, really hated the Persians. And so they just kind of came at the Persians with a fury and annihilated them when they got there. And so Greece comes to prominence. It wasn't so much a great nation as it was a great general, even more so than Babylon. When Alexander died, it was kind of the end of things for a unified Greek empire. But Alexander conquered more land with more speed than anybody up to that point in history. And at the absolute height of his power, at the ripe old age of 32, he died. And there was no successor, and there was a lot of civil war after that, and we won't go through all the details of that. But basically what happened is the Greek Empire wound up settling out into four basic parts, ruled by four of his generals. And two of those are significant for the biblical history and the history of God's people. The Seleucids, who reigned to the north of Palestine, Syria, and that part of the Fertile Crescent, and the Ptolemies, who reigned down in Egypt. And they quickly became rivals, trying to become the most significant part of the Greek Empire, and really to kind of become the Greek Empire, the new Greek Empire. And the Seleucids and the Ptolemies fought back and forth for a long time over who was going to be supreme in that region. And of course, since the Jews are literally in the middle of that battle, the fighting back and forth just trampled all over them. Whichever one of them was the stronger, the Seleucids, the Ptolemies, whichever one was the stronger, they were pretty much ruling in Palestine there for a little while as well. Ultimately, you come to the eighth ruler of the Seleucids, a fellow named Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, he's called sometimes. And he was brilliant in one sense, and he was absolutely out of his mind in another sense. He was someone that had no legitimate claim to the throne. He was like third or fourth in succession to be king, and wound up getting himself to be king. But he also had a crazy ego. He gave himself the name Epiphanes, which means something like God manifest. So that'll kind of give you an idea of where he stands on things. People called him behind his back Epimenes instead of Epiphanes, which means madman. But he ran into the Romans as they were rising in power. And basically the transition of world power from the Greeks to the Romans happens during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. In Egypt he runs into the Romans, who humiliate him, put him in his place. This is the scene where they kind of, he says, they say you must withdraw. You need to get out of here or you're at war with Rome. And he says, I need to go confer with my generals and we'll make a decision. So they draw a circle in the sand around him and say, you make a decision before you step out of the circle or you're at war with Rome. And so there was nothing he could do except tuck his tail between his legs and get out of there. And as he left Egypt, he went back through Palestine and was extremely angry as he was going back through, and he found a bunch of Jews that he could beat on to take out some of his wrath. And that's an oversimplification. But he persecuted, ultimately, he persecutes Israel to a level that they had never known before. They've been defeated, they've been carried off into captivity, a lot of them had died. But in terms of, you're here, you're staying here, and I'm just going to mercilessly persecute you and make your religion a focus of the persecution, they've never been through anything like that before. He attacked Jerusalem. He slaughtered all kinds of people. He outlawed Jewish worship. He outlawed all of their religious rites and traditions. He ordered worship of Zeus instead of worship of God. He turned the temple into a sanctuary to Zeus. And as a part of his offering to Zeus, he sacrificed and offered a pig on the altar in Jerusalem to Zeus. You want to talk about something that is the height of offensiveness to a Jew. It's taking the temple, the most holy place that there is, turning it into a shrine to Zeus, and offering a pig, an unclean animal, on the altar to Zeus at the temple. And this is ultimately what leads to the Maccabean Revolt. And we won't get into that right now. So that's your 5-ish minute history of Persia and Greece, which gives us some background here for the text. Any questions about that? Like I said, I don't want to get too bogged down there. I think I kind of hit the high points that are helpful for understanding this, and we'll have to come back to it a little bit more detail when we get to chapter 11, because that's really, 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 really rooted in history. Yeah. All right. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Well, why is it in the New Testament, whenever the gods, like Zeus or Mercury, Hermes, come up? Why are they referred to by the Greek names and not the Roman names?
Because the New Testament's written in Greek.
Ah, there you go.
I don't know. That seems like a good guess to me. The Romans, their pantheon of gods is a ripoff of the Greeks.
Right.
All they did was come along and say, oh, your gods, we like those, we'll give them new names. And it may be a little bit more complex than that, but I'm not sure how much more complex than that it really is. All of the Roman gods are just Greek gods with a new name. Why does the New Testament use the Greek name instead of the Roman name? It may be as simple as this in the Greek language, but I'm not sure. Hey. Any other questions I don't know the answer to? There's a lot of them. You just have to know which ones to ask. All right, so I won't belabor this point, but just to mention, we're going back to Hebrew now in the original book of Daniel. You might remember that chapter 2 through 7, most of chapters 2 through 7, was in Aramaic. And that section of the text is largely concerned with world empires and God's sovereignty over them. With chapter 8, we return to a focus on God's people. The temple is talked about a lot. Sacrifices are talked about a lot. The captivity and return are talked about a lot in this section of the book. And with the return to God's people, it returns to the language of God's people. I don't know if that's why it does, but that's as good of a guess as I've got. And so the world-focused part is in the more world language. The Jewish-focused part is in the Jewish language. Why it was written that way, I don't know. maybe it's that, maybe it's something else. But it's an interesting thing because we talked about this way back in the beginning, and again, I don't want to get bogged down on this, but there's a sense in which chapter 7 begins a new section of the book of Daniel. Chapter 1 through 6 is narrative, chapter 7 through 12 is apocalyptic vision. And so we're in the beginning of a new section in chapter 7, yet in the also very legitimate way of dividing the book up, chapter 7 is in a different section. It's in the middle section of 3. It's the end of a section, not the beginning of a section. It's the beginning of the apocalyptic, it's the end of the Aramaic. And it's an interesting thing that's happening there that I think points us in the direction of nothing else, that you can't just simplistically divide up the book of Daniel in those very critical, skeptical scholars that will say, you know, Daniel was written much, much later. Maybe the narratives are early and these apocalyptic visions are late and they're not really prophecy and all of that. There's two different sections of Daniel. But you can't divide it up that simplistically. The book doesn't allow for it the way that it's written. Well, with that out of the way, let's work our way through some of this text here. Daniel chapter 8, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at first. So a couple years have passed since the last vision. You might remember the end of the last vision. As for me, this is verse 28 of chapter 7. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. That's kind of similar to the description of Belshazzar when he saw the handwriting on the wall. Not all of it is there, but some of it is there. This was not an easy experience for Daniel. So my guess is he's probably not going around going, oh boy, I can't wait for that next vision to come. These are so cool. It's so exciting that he, you know, his thoughts are alarming him, and he's going through physiological things that are along with that fear. So a couple years have passed. He's probably pretty relieved that he's not had that experience again. And then, well, here it comes again. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was like, now, I raised my eyes, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one that could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of the heaven. Let me stop there for a second. We'll talk about this male goat and the ram, this part of the vision, before we move on to the little horn that will follow next. So we're in the third year of Belshazzar's reign, like I say, a couple years after the vision of chapter 7. This is also not too terribly long before the events of chapter 5. We talked about the chronology of Daniel before, but just to remind you, chapters 1 through 6 is chronological. Chapters 7 through 12 is chronological, but there's a little bit of an overlap. So you get to chapter 7 and it jumps back a few years and then starts moving forward again. So we are after 7, a little bit before 5, and then progressing forward after that point. In his vision, he goes, so this is not the angel takes him there, but in the vision, he goes to Susa, which is one of three different capitals of the Persian Empire. We'll talk about that in passing. But this was the main capital of the Persian Empire over in Elam. This is where Susa was. Eventually it becomes that. But that's what it's known as ultimately, is the primary capital of the Persian Empire. And so when you have a ram standing in Susa, and I'll talk more about the ram itself, which is kind of a Persian symbol, it's pretty clear that's who is being talked about. About here. So there's this ram that's standing on the canal of the Ulai Canal, on the bank of the Ulai Canal in Susa. He has two horns. One is bigger than the other, and the bigger one came up last. Remember, one of the things we talked about in interpreting these visions, you know, which details are important, which ones are unimportant. Well, one of the kind of standard rules for knowing what is important is if it is a stock image that shows up in vision after vision after vision and always has the same meaning, that's probably going to carry the same meaning any other time it comes up. And horns show up in loads of these visions, and they're always a symbol of power. So if you have a ram with two horns, I mean, just think about that in itself. What is the strength of the ram? It's bull, right? Obviously. No. The horns. And if you've got a ram with two giant horns, you stay away from that ram. And so this is a symbol of the ram's power. It has two horns. One is bigger than the other. The bigger one comes up second. So you can even imagine Daniel watching them grow. One starts a little bit bigger, and then the other one grows up after it. And again, this is a perfect way of describing the Medo-Persian Empire. There are two sources of power. The larger source comes second, not first. And so the Medes are the stronger power to begin with, and the Persians become by far the stronger power of the two. The ram, we are told, somewhere when I find my place, charges westward and northward and southward. Remember I said the Persians were well on the east of this part of civilization. All their campaigns, which way were they? I mean, westward and northward and southward. Again, very pretty clear description of the Persian Empire going on here. No beast could stand before him. Well, what is a beast? See chapter 7. What are the beasts? They're other nations. What is the ram and the goat here? They're nations. So when no beast could stand before this ram, it's saying no nation could stand before them. So whoever the Persians attacked, they demolished. And again, that's exactly what happens. This is all lining up very well with history. And then finally along these lines, just to put this again back in historical context, to make it even more clear that he's talking about the Persians here. The ram itself was associated with the Persian Empire. There's one particular ancient book that talks about the guardian spirit of the Persian kingdom appearing in the form of a ram. There's a 4th century historian that says the Persian king, when he stood at the head of his army, would bear the head of a ram going into battle. And so for a ram to symbolize Persians here, and all of these different details to perfectly fit the Persian Empire, makes it pretty clear that he's talking about the Persians. Also, when you get to verse 20, the angel says, as for the ram you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. So, also, the angel gives the answer away at the end. And I'll go ahead and mention in passing now, just to give it away. Verse 21, the goat is the king of Greece, and the horn between his eyes is the first king. So, remember what I said last week? It wasn't that the angel couldn't name those four beasts in chapter 7 if he wanted to. Yeah, he can name them if he wants to. When he doesn't name them, that's probably a clue that our primary purpose is not to figure out all the details of who these people and things are. Except, again, where it's just obvious from historical context. We'll see that in chapter 11 pretty specifically. So, we come to the goat then. The goat, we are told, comes from the west. Well, what's the far extreme? If Persia is the far extreme east, what's the far extreme west? Well, again, verse 21 gives you the answer. The Greeks are the far other end of the Mediterranean world, and that's where he's coming from. He covers the whole earth without touching the ground. Can you imagine a goat? And I don't think the point is that the goat is like literally flying. As much as it's moving so fast, it looks like it's not even touching the ground. You probably, you know, watch a nature documentary, you see a cheetah run, and you're like, holy cow, I don't think that thing's touching the ground. It's moving so fast. You can barely see its legs. I think that's kind of the idea here, is that this goat is just, and it's the speed that Alexander conquered and the extent of the earth that he conquered at that speed, the whole earth without touching the ground, is how far he moved and how fast he moved. It is a pretty remarkable thing. The one horn, of course, is Alexander. The one conspicuous horn. They might have a different translation there than conspicuous. I've never really liked that.
Prominent?
Prominent, okay. Yeah, that's more of the idea. The word means something like visible, is what the word means in a more literal sense. But a visible horn, yeah, oh boy, I can see it. It doesn't just mean visible. It means very, very, very visible. So prominent, conspicuous is a word that works. It kind of has a connotation, though, that might drive your interpretation in a different direction. So it's a very prominent, noticeable horn is what it is. And as it crosses, notice he runs at the ram in his powerful wrath. In particular, the text says that gets us back to the Greek anger at the Persians in attacking the ram, not just because they're in the way, but on a deeper motivational level than just that as well. And he breaks the two horns, we are told, and so now the ram is powerless without its source of power, the previously unconquerable power of the Persian Empire. Remember, no one could stop the ram. Wherever it went, nothing could stand in its way. Well, the goat does. It comes and it breaks the horns of the ram, just like the Persians. The Persians had done whatever they wanted to with anyone else. Well, now the Greeks do that to Persians. Is what's going to happen here. Yet, that's also not the end of the story, because when the goat is at the height of its strength, and in particular this horn that is this incredible source of its power, at the height of its strength, that breaks. And this is, again, very clearly a reference to the death, the very unexpected death of Alexander. And this is one of those things, there's historical debate as to exactly what happened to Alexander, whether it was poisoning or some sort of illness. Basically, the only way it could be some sort of poisoning is if it were a very, very slow-acting poison, because from the time that his sickness began until he died was far too long. It was like a week or two or something like that. Far too long for most poisons to work. And so most people are now speculating. I mean, there are some that still say, well, it could be this or it could be that kind of poison. But most people are saying it was some sort of illness that he contracted. But he gets to Babylon and seems to be fine, and then a couple weeks later he's dead. And what do you do now? I mean, he certainly, I mean, there is a child, but he's not in any position to take over the Greek Empire. And so now you've got this real problem, and ultimately it's going to be divided up into four new sources of power. So the four horns toward the four winds of the heaven. The four winds of the heaven is referenced in north, south, east, and west. So these four different generals, to put this in historical context, will divide the Greek Empire up into four parts, and each of them will rule a part of the Greek Empire. And instead of staying as four separate parts, they start fighting with each other, because each of them wants to become the predominant part of the empire. They want to ultimately be the successor to Alexander and the world conqueror. And none of them ever will. Seleucus and the Ptolemies are undoubtedly the strongest of all of them by the end, but neither one of them can defeat the other with any lasting significance or expand. I mean, they will briefly tread into the other's ground for a little while, but then ultimately be pushed back. So no one ever succeeds in the way that Alexander had. All right, any questions about this first part of the vision, or the history behind it, or anything else? All right, well, continuing on then in verse 9, out of one of them, that is of the four horns, out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of that host, and some of the stars that threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great even as great as the prince of the host, and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of the sanctuary was overthrown, and a host will be given over together with the regular burnt offering because of the transgression, and it will pour fruit to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard one of the holy ones speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" Then he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." Perfectly clear, isn't it? So what's going on here? Well, there is this little horn that grows up here out of one of the four, and it starts as a little horn. That's where little word terminology always comes from, but it ultimately grows to be great. I'm always tempted to make a little big horn joke here, but I'm going to do that. So it'd probably be my last stand if I made that kind of joke. So I'll refrain. So it starts small, but ultimately grows to be... Aren't you impressed with the self-control I have? It grows to be great and very powerful here. It will grow, it says, to the south, to the east, and to the glorious land. And so you think about this, and you put this in context, and although he is not named here, it is clear historically that we are talking about Antiochus IV. That becomes pretty clear as this develops, and again in chapter 11, when we come back to this era, it's pretty clear that's who's being talked about here. So he is a Seleucid king, so up in Syria is basically where the Seleucids begin. And so they grow to the east. He's pushing back toward the Persian side of things, toward Babylon and all of that, conquering in that direction. Into the south, he's coming down and trying to take over Egypt and expand his empire that way. And toward the glorious land, well, that's still to the south. That's Palestine, pretty obviously. The promised land is what's being talked about. That's still to the south, but Daniel wants to make it clear that this is a separate sort of thing from his just empire building. He's trying to build the empire to the east. He's trying to build the empire to the south. And then in a very specific way, he's attacking the promised land. And he's going to be doing that, as we said, in a very pointed sort of way that the people hadn't endured before. And also toward the host of the heaven, which is a remarkable thing. He's going to attack God. Well, not in a literal sense, but he will do this more so than most others up to this point. And we run into that a little bit with Belshazzar before. Nebuchadnezzar, for all of his faults, when God smacks him in the face, he listens. When God shows his power of deliverance, Nebuchadnezzar goes, wow, this God can really deliver. When he shows his power of knowledge, wow, this God can really reveal things. When he shows his power over Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar humbles himself. Belshazzar, meanwhile, is like, hey, let's go get those temple vessels and get drinking out of them. That's bad enough. Well, Antiochus and what he will do is blaspheme God directly, defile the temple. He will try to outlaw Jewish worship. He is taking his attack to the very throne of God is what he's going to do. And he will glorify himself in all of this. As great as the prince of the host. And this language, the prince of the host, is an interesting sort of phrase. We'll run into these princes more over the course of the book of Daniel. The princes are the spiritual figure that stands behind a nation. So there is the prince of Persia, we'll run into later on, who withstands an angel from God. And that tells you, first of all, it's not a human prince. It's a spiritual prince of some kind. And then we will be told about the prince of your people, Michael. And we learn, as the Bible unfolds, that Michael is the archangel. And he is the prince of God's people as well. That he is the spiritual force behind the Israelite army or something along those lines. So the prince of the host is some sort of spiritual figure. And he's lifting himself up as if he is that great. He's ultimately trying to equate himself with God, is what he's doing with his name, Epiphanes. And not only does he give himself that name, but there have been coins that have been excavated from his time that he apparently minted that say Antiochus IV, God manifests. So, I mean, self-confidence was not his problem. Actually, it was his problem, but in a different sort of direction, I guess. And he will oppose the worship of God as well. He will, stop the regular burnt offering. He will overthrow the sanctuary. Sanctuary, of course, being a reference to the temple. So this is an attack on God himself. And I don't know if you caught this as we were going through this, but in verse 12, is because of transgression. We'll come back to that in a minute. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. That this attack on God and his people is going to succeed. And that is part of this prophecy. When this awful, awful thing happens, it's going to prosper. And so God's not going to stand in its way. They think God's going to stand back and let it happen is what he's going to do. And this is equated in some sense with transgression. It's because of transgression that this is going to happen. And again, we'll come back to that in just a moment. And so he hears a holy one speaking, and another holy one speaking back to him. So there's this conversation, this spiritual conversation that's happening. And one of them says, well, how long is this going to happen? You're reminded of what Peter says in his first letter. There are things that angels desire to look into, things that are happening on this earth that they don't even understand. Here's one of them. How long is this going to happen? But notice that question itself. I think there's something important there in that question. The question isn't, why is this happening? That's what we would want to know, right? Especially if we were living through it. God, why are you letting this happen? Well, what they presume, what they take as a given, is God's letting it happen for a reason. Whatever that reason is, whether I know it or not, is irrelevant. God's in control. And so the question isn't why. The question is how long. And when is this going to come to an end? And the answer is 2,300 evenings and mornings. Oh, okay, perfect. I'll start marking the calendar, right? Well, that in itself is a little bit ambiguous because it could mean one of two things. It could be a reference to Genesis 1. There was evening, there was morning, one day. So if 2,300 evenings and mornings is a reference to 2,300 days, then, well, it's 2,300 days. See how that works? However, it also might be a reference to the evening and morning sacrifice, which happened at the temple day by day. And notice the context of the temple, the regular burnt offerings. And so if the 2,300 is a reference to the evening and morning sacrifice, then it could be cut in half at that point, in which case we're talking about 1,150 days, which is roughly, it's a little bit over 3 years. 3 years and a couple months or something along those lines. And that is an appealing interpretation because the Zeus shrine at the temple that Nike had set up lasted for roughly 3 years. And so that'd be a good round number, and the context of the evening and morning sacrifice fits well here too. So that's what I'm leaning toward as far as interpreting that, but it's hard to know for sure, especially when you get into numbers and apocalyptic visions. They're almost never literal. So 2,300 evenings and mornings, it's a long time, it's a limited time. That's what I will regularly come back to with these big numbers. It's going to be a long time, it's going to be a while, you're going to have to get used to it, you're going to have to endure it, but understand it's limited, it will be coming to an end. It's not happening forever, it's not happening for a couple of days, it'll be going on for a while, but God is in control and God will bring it to an end. And so then, Daniel wants to know what's going on, and I won't take the time to read all of this because time's quickly getting away. But Daniel sees the vision, he seeks to understand it, and Gabriel comes to interpret it. Notice verse 16, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. This is the first time in the Old Testament that an angel is named, for what it's worth, if you're interested in that kind of trivia. If you're ever coming by the trivia and that's a question, you know, if you're ever on Final Jeopardy and this wins you the big money, I deserve a cut. This is the first time the angel is named. Daniel's the only Old Testament book where angels are named as well. But Gabriel is the one who comes bringing this information. His name means mighty man of God. All of those kind of cartoony Hallmark pictures of angels, that's not what angels look like. Just about every time an angel shows up and they're recognizable as an angel, what happens is the person falls on his face in terror, and they have to be helped up off the ground. So don't think of cute little Cupid or something when you think of angels. Think of mighty warriors who are doing spiritual battles is what you are better to imagine, at least as far as you can. He is the one who shows up to make this interpretation. Notice in verse 17, he says, understand, O Son of Man, that the vision is for the time of the end. It's the end times, right? This is going to be right before the Lord comes back. And, well, that's one way of interpreting that phrase, I suppose. But notice the context here. Verse 13, how long is this going to take place? verse 19, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation." So, this awful thing is going to happen. The question is, how long is it going to take place? The interpretation is going to be what's going to happen at the end of this period of persecution. So when he says this is about the time of the end, what is the end that he's talking about in context? Not the end of the world, the end of the time of Antiochus. The end of the goat, you might say, as well, as far as that goes. This is the end of Greek power, is what this is the end of. The end of Seleucid power is what it's the end of as well. So that's almost certainly the context there. So as the interpretation unfolds further, as we've already said, even if you couldn't figure it out from historical cues and markers and understanding the vision, Gabriel makes it very clear. The ram are the kings of Media and Persia. The goat is Greece. The great horn is the first king. And as it's broken, four others that arise, four kingdoms or four kings shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. The latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise, and so forth and so on it goes. So, again, the four horns of these four kingdoms or kings that arise from Greece. The little horn is Antiochus the Fourth. He's not named the way the rest of it is, but there's no one else it could be in historical context but Antiochus the Fourth or Antiochus Epiphanes. He's very clever. He's brave in a sense. He's intellectually gifted. And when you have someone that has boldness and intellectual acuity, that means there's someone who can do really, really good things with their life or really, really bad things with their life. And it just depends on which path they choose. And that's who this person is. He chooses, of course, the bad path. And so he has great power. He's going to make deceit prosper. He will destroy without warning. He's great in his own mind, if nothing else. And he will succeed. But notice again, verse 23, when the transgressions have reached their limit is when this king will arise. Well, what are these transgressions, or the transgressors in verse 23, the transgressions back in verse 12 that's connected with this? What are these transgressions? Who are these transgressors? Well, there are a couple of ways of reading this as well, both of which can make sense in the biblical context. It could be Greek transgressions. That Antiochus is the final stage of the building ultimate judgment of the kingdom of Greece. And the judgment of the Greek kingdom will not begin until the measure of sin has reached its point to make it inevitable. Think of what God said to Abraham, right? When will they come back and take the promised land? Well, when iniquity is complete. When the iniquity of the Amorites is complete, then you'll come back there. When it's time for them to be judged, then I'll judge them. And so some read this as the culmination of the Greek transgressions, and Rome will displace Greece during the time of Antiochus IV. And that's one way of reading this. The other way of reading it is that it's Jewish transgressions, and the Jews are being punished because of Jewish transgressions. And again, that fits biblical context very well also, because of the multiplicity of times the prophets say, repent or you're going to be judged, repent or you're going to be punished. And one of the things that Antiochus will do is convince a whole bunch of Jews to behave like Greeks instead of like Jews, on a moral level as well as whatever other cultural level they might. And so if that's the case, then Antiochus the Fourth and what he does is God's punishment against them for their transgression. And I don't know that we can pin it down and say it must be one or the other. I mean, you could maybe make a stronger argument one way or the other, lean more in one way or the other, but it's really hard to know for sure. Well, ultimately, as the vision comes to its end, notice in verse 27, Daniel has yet again a similar reaction. I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. Again, this is just a monumentally difficult experience for Daniel. It's not a small thing to receive a divine vision. I've got a great quote I'll share in a couple of classes somewhere along the way. About this, but the flippancy with which some people say they talk to God boggles your mind when you realize what happens when Daniel talks not to God, but to an angel. It's not a light thing to have a conversation with the Almighty. And we think of Daniel 1 through 6 as the tough part of the book for Daniel. You know, where he's thrown in the lion's dens and things like that. Well, chapter 7 through 12 are about as hard on Daniel as 1 through 6 was, once you realize the physical, emotional, psychological toll that these visions will take on him. And I'll say one more thing about that here in a second. As always, I'm running over, but we don't have to wait for pits to come out of the back, so I'll keep running over for a minute or two. Questions or comments about anything here we talked about?
I was thinking, well, it doesn't go as far out of its way as many other chapters really say, but God rules over the kingdoms of men. It does mention multiple times that, well, these are all visions saying exactly what's going to happen. These kingdoms will rise, these kingdoms will fall, and even this transgressor, his days are literally numbered in this. God knows exactly how long this is going to be allowed to happen, and it says in a few of the different verses, his power shall be great, but it's not by his own power. And he's going to be judged at the end of this.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is what we've been kind of hammering away at this entire class, right? The twin message of the book of Daniel, there are two sides of the same coin. The Most High rules the kingdoms of men, and in spite of present appearances, God is in control. And with his people, he and his people will win the victory. It's not as overt here, but it is implicit all the way through. You can't predict hundreds of years in advance what's going to happen without being the one who's in control. And that's part of what's going on here. Martha?
I was going to say the first six chapters helped prepare him to handle this. Mm-hmm. Plus, the fact that he was put in those situations showed him to be the man that could take care of this.
Good thought. Edith?
There's something that I would like to ask about verse 14, where it talks about the 2300 evenings and mornings.
Yes.
Because there's a time period between 170 B.C. and 160. 4 BC, where, I don't know if you know, there's a high priest, Onias the Third, and he was one of the significant high priests, and he got, I think he was assassinated during 170 BC, and then in 164 BC, that's when, like, Antiochus was killed, and the temple was rededicated around that time.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a possibility?
If you're taking 2300 as 2300 days instead of 1150 days, that's typically the way that it's seen as fitting that roughly 6 year period is Onias and Antiochus. Yeah, that's pretty one of the common things. Yeah, thanks.
I guess I just find it how it's interesting where premillennials make a huge jump there, where if you take everything in context and take the most conservative interpretation, it's the end of the time of what was going on. I mean, because everything there is just, you know, specific time periods that are defined. All of a sudden, they make this huge leap. I have to say that my final word does this. End of times.
Mm-hmm.
Christ is coming. It's like, just for no reason at all, they make this huge leap. And everything in context seems to be...
Well, and you have to ignore the context that there is an end that is specifically being talked about in this chapter. There's not the end of time. And you have to ignore that in order to make the time of the end mean the end of everything.
And that's exactly how God translated. They changed time of the end to end of time.
End of time, yeah. Well, as I've been doing, I want to end with a quote that I've come across that I think is a helpful thing to think about as we end today. Actually, I've got two of them. They're both too long. So I'll move through these very quickly. Two different authors talking specifically about the phrase, "Then I rose and went about the king's business." So he has this vision, he has these insights, he goes through this turmoil, and then what does he do when he's ready? He gets up and goes back to work and just goes about his daily life. So Andy Gibbs says, Martin Luther was once asked what he would do if he knew the world would come to an end tomorrow. His response was that he would plant a tree. Luther understood that the imminence of the end does not diminish the value of faithful labors for God here and now. So too, whether our calling is changing diapers or cleaning the kitchen, filing reports, or designing aircraft, painting pictures, or making music, teaching students, or tending the sick, we should be about whatever business the great king has assigned us. Whenever our master returns, whether soon or at a distant time, he should find us obediently and productively at work when he comes. I think that's a really helpful thing to think about. And then Christopher Wright, this one's really long, so sorry. Daniel had just had this incredible vision. It was appalling and scary, yes, but it was also prophetic and, in some sense at least, exciting. He had seen the future, but he did not go around ranting like some wild prophet of doom, nor did he set up a lucrative end times ministry, complete with websites, movies, and books. Well, perhaps one book. No, he just got up and went about the king's business. The fact that he'd become aware of potentially beastly, and we might add satanic, spiritual dimensions that are at work within the social, political, and economic structures of the state did not make him decide to opt out of secular employment altogether, reject any involvement in political life, and inhabit a marginalized world of spiritual piety. No, he understood only too well the dimensions of the present and future, but he took that understanding with him into his work. He went about the king's business, knowing that he was, at the same time, going about the business of the true King of Kings. So I think these two authors said very well a lot out of that one little phrase in terms of thinking practically about that. I am well past time. I'm going to stop talking now, and we'll get into chapter 9 next.